tree means life, means the chain of life, also means the roots, no? There is a part of the tree that you never see that are the roots that are as important or more important than the top part, no? And that it's the same for us, no? Our roots, our history, it's even more important than our present.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.
Today's guest is the artist Bosco Zuri. Hi, Bosco.
Hi, Johan. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. Bosco, tell me, how did you get into art?
Well, when I was 6 years old, I was diagnosed with a deficit of attention, hyperactivity, and dyslexia, the three amigos. And my mother, instead of medicating me, that was time in the 70s, it was very normal to medicate. She decided to put me on art classes. These were very Montessori art classes where I can go and choose the materials I want to use. And just the teacher just was guiding me, not telling me what to do, but just guiding me. And for me, it was a therapy. So for me, art has been a therapy all my life. It's a necessity.
And when did the possibility of becoming a professional artist occur in your life? Were there like some role models you were following?
Well, I was following since very young. My mother and my father, they were big fans of art in general. So I grew up, of course, seeing books mostly because we didn't have the money to travel abroad, but books about Picasso, about Matisse, about Braque, of course, Rivera, Tamayo, Toledo, even Richard Serra, Tapies at the time. And but the first time I was aware that there was maybe a possibility to live from art, and I'm sure that a lot of artists that are hearing this conversation, they know that it's really difficult to become a professional artist and live from art. It was after getting married, I went to live in Paris. I was working at that time in a company there in Paris half time, friends of my father. And but I have a studio at home, and I begin to every day I was doing art as my therapy, mm-hmm. since I have done since 6 years old.
What was the company doing?
It was a company specializing in animal food. Uh huh. And I was working there 4 hours a day from I don't remember very well, but from I think 9 to 1 o'clock or something like that.
So the art you was doing, you were pretty much doing for yourself?
Yes, just for myself. And I was doing work on papers because, of course, we were in Paris and it was a very small apartment. And then I did, I don't know, 40 or 50 works on paper. And when we were going to go back to Mexico 2 or 3 months before, I took some of the works to frame at Rue des Beaux-Arts. And I left them there. And when I went to pick them up, the owner of the framing company, he told me I have several people that wants to buy the works.
So clients of his who saw it then, yeah?
Yes, clients that were framing there, of course, maybe not even professional collectors, I don't know. And he asked me what will be the price. I didn't know how to price anything, of course. But then we sold them and we stayed 1 more month. And then that's when I begin to think, well, maybe it's going to be possible to live from what I love the most and from my therapy. That was the beginning.
Okay, wow. So, and your recent exhibition here at König Galerie St. Agnes is called Mon Père. And you installed an olive tree in the middle of the space, which is very beautiful now, finally. Spring has come and we have long winters in Berlin. Surrounded of the tree are, what are they? They are paintings or reliefs, almost installed like church windows. Maybe you can take us a little bit on the concept of the show.
Bueno, the whole concept of the show was, the title was Mon Père, and I was talking about your father, my father, no? We have had difficult times, but also a lot of people that how important the father figure is for us as a mother figure. But I wanted to talk about my father. I want to dedicate this show to my father, to your father, to every father. And what the olive tree means, in a way, means that, no, means life, means peace, means force, means stability, growing. And I wanted to surround it by 10 paintings that I did in my house in Folegandros, in my studio in Folegandros in Greece. Green paintings there, I call them paintings, but for example, in Japan, they call me sculptor, they don't call me painter.
Mm-hmm.
They are the objects in a way, no?
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk about that, about, having the opportunity to show in such a special place, ex-church in a way, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not religious, but I believe in sacred spaces. And I wanted to create something that mesmerize the essence of life, the essence of beauty, the essence of the force, and just to remind us that we're here for a minute, but how important is our roots.
And so the tree, I think also, I guess it's quite global that this is like a goal of life to plant a tree.
Yes, in certain ways, yes, a tree means life, means the chain of life. Well, also means the roots, no? There is a part of the tree that you never see that are the roots that are as important or more important than the top part, no? And that it's the same for us, no? Our roots, our history, it's even more important than our present.
And the paintings or objects, tell us how you create them. It's a long process?
Well, the intervention is not so long. The drying is long. But the idea was to make, all these paintings in Folegandros, I wanted to do them in green. They're made with a Hansa yellow that I bought in India a long time ago, mixed with blues and greens, with objects that I have find in my walks in Folegandros. In the island, there I do long walks, and I always collect objects that I find interesting or beautiful or strong.
Mm-hmm.
In all of these paintings, I have these objects, not print, in the painting, inside the painting. And talking about this, also I like this concept of the painting becoming
it's sort of arte povera, right?
It's arte povera, but yeah. Also it's to talk about life, it's to talk about the essence of things, it's to talk about the beginnings, it's to talk about the power of life, the power of nature.
Yeah, and the simplicity.
Yes.
So, and what's the process? Is there a canvas? Is there a stretcher?
Sí. There are all my paintings. So, almost all of my paintings are made in a stretcher. Mm-hmm. I like to work with canvas because the canvas, when you work with so much texture, it becomes much more uneven.
Mm-hmm.
And when it becomes much more uneven, you have more accident and less control.
Okay. So, and the panels are about 40 by 60 centimeters, more or less, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And then you stretch the canvas on wood stretcher?
Yes.
And then what's the next step?
Well, next step, I put them on horizontal, and I begin to apply layers of pigment mixed with sawdust, with glue, with latex, big amounts of pigment. Each one of these paintings has at least 3 to 5 kilos of pigment.
Okay. So, and then you make many layers? And how, like, what's the process then? Because they sort of crack over time, but that's something you can't really control, right?
Yeah, 100%. One of the main things that I do, it's when I work on the painting as far as when I see the first crack. When I see the first crack, I stop and I let the painting go by itself.
Ah, okay.
Because I want the painting to have this feeling and this approach and this, let's say, closeness to nature.
And the aura and the presence. And there are like different elements you pick up in nature.
Yes.
And how do you apply these on the canvas? So it's multi-layered.
See, it's multi-layered, but at the very end of the painting, I choose an object and I just apply it to the painting, depending on the object, depending on the feeling of the painting on the day. But I have a whole table with several objects that I have been collecting since 5 years there.
Mm-hmm.
Then I go and look for one and that I think it makes an essence with that painting. So the work is fixed automatically because the essence, the way the composition of the material is that it has glue, latex, it absorbs the work and make it stay.
Okay, and then there's a lot of water.
There is a lot of water involved at the beginning.
Yeah.
But then when it dries, that's why the cracks come, and also that's why my work is so dependent on the weather, because humidity, chemical composition of the water, chemical composition of the sawdust make the result totally different.
And how when do you bring in the pigment?
No, at the very beginning.
Ah, okay. So you mix...
I mix the sawdust with the pigment.
So what sawdust?
Any kind of sawdust. That's also something very important on my work, that I go to the closest wood shop and I ask for any sawdust that they have. So sometimes the sawdust becomes very important as a pigment, because sometimes the sawdust is from a dark wood or from a pine tree, or and they have different chemical compositions, and the reaction with the water, mm-hmm. with the pigment is completely different.
So sawdust, so it's like Hobelspäne. So when you
yes.
make a table or yes. A door,
exactly.
Then you create the remains
exactly.
That's of sawdust. Woodwork. Okay, yes. so dust.
Sawdust.
Okay. And this is mixed with pigment?
This is mixed with water, glue, latex, and pigment. Big quantities of pigment. And I make a kind of mask that I apply
yeah.
to the painting. I drop to the painting. I go around throwing pigments to the on top of the painting. It's a very physical process. Very
yeah.
physical
and you process. Do it outside?
What do you mean?
You do the on the.
Well, the color comes from the inside too. Eh?
No, but I mean the process is uh-huh. is this plein air, like on the
no.
That's in the studio.
In the studio.
Okay.
So, I mean, for example, in the studio in Greece, the doors are always open. There's a lot of air coming by.
Yeah.
But I never do it on the outside, because if you do it on the outside, well, I have done it a few times, but if you do it on the outside, the drying process become much more faster and I have less time to intervene in the painting.
Ah, okay. And you intervene until the first crack appears
yes.
as a signal of dryness.
Yes.
So it's almost like a dialogue with the nature forces.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then this tells you when it's like... And how selective are you on the... So then you let the painting be, and how long does it dry? And for how long?
It depends on the place, but it can take 3 weeks or 4 weeks.
Okay.
To totally dry.
And then you accept it as it is, or you sometimes say, okay, this didn't work out?
No, I accept it normally 99% of the time. I accept it as it is.
Okay.
Because remember that the whole philosophy of my work is based on the wabi-sabi aesthetic, so how mm-hmm. the accident, the non-control,
mm-hmm.
the unpredictable... To work with organic materials, the passing of times makes things unique and irrepeatable. And that's the whole essence of my work, not just in the paintings, but also in the sculptures, in the performances, in everything that I have done.
But when did you accept to give up on control? Because I guess at the beginning you were like, there was a brush stroke on the canvas.
No, never a brush.
Oh, never. Okay, so how did you
everything
do
it? Everything with hands.
When you mentioned the paperwork. At the beginning.
See, no, but everything is by hand.
Yeah.
Touching, drawing.
At the beginning, there was more control, no?
See, when I can choose the size of the painting, I can choose the color. But I never use a brush like that. I mean, sometimes just to retouch a painting when they're damaged. But we have to remember that for me, this is a therapy. And in order for me to act as a therapy, I have to be in contact with the paintings. I don't have assistants. I have never had an assistant. On the studio, you know, I like to stretch. I like to assemble the stretches. I like to be in touch and this exchange of energy between me and the work, in order for me to have my daily therapy.
I guess this moment on, you know, to have like nature forces more involved, was it from the beginning or was it a later point where
you begin to learn? No, you begin to learn. Of course, at the beginning, after Paris, we went to live in Barcelona. And in Barcelona, I had a studio in a more serious way. And a lot of accidents bring me to this kind of work that I do that I think is very unique. I don't know any artist that worked with sawdust before me in this way. And the way what happened is one day I went to see a show at Thyssen-Bornemisza Museum in Madrid, and there was a Braque show that my mother loves Braque. And I bought the catalog for her. And at the coming back, I was reading the catalog and I saw that Braque used to put a little bit of sawdust in order to give texture to the paintings, because he didn't have money to buy more oil painting.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, why don't use much more, why don't I begin to experiment with sawdust? Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, I was very shy in the way I was using the sawdust. But then one day I have a whole bucket full of sawdust, the same mixture I told you, the sawdust with the glue and the latex. And I was supposed to pick up my kids that they were in the school nearby from my studio in Barcelona. And by accident, I dropped the bucket of the sawdust, but I had to leave. I didn't have time to clean it. Mm-hmm. So I went, I picked up the kids in the school. That was a Friday. At the end, I was not able to come back to the studio until Monday morning. Mm-hmm. And then I saw this thing in the floor that was beautiful, like an object cracking, like a part of nature. And I said, well, why don't I try to implement this in the paintings? And then it has been, of course, a long time of researching, failing, and but at the end.
Yeah, and also the sculptures, right? The spheres you create and the stacks. But I think it's interesting to let go of control, no? Because I think when you create something, then it's an automatic impulse to keep control and be in the driving seat to really, yeah, have full control in the result. But here you, as you say, the painting signals to you, or the sculpture, when you have to get your hands off.
Well, that's the Occidental way of seeing things, no? That we have to have control on everything, no? On how we age, on our life, on the addiction to internet or Instagram or whatever. And I think we have to learn how to lose control of our lives and live it in a more free way.
And let go.
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm, of mm-hmm. course, it's the only chance that we're going to have to. I mean, we're, as we know, everybody hearing this, we're in a very turbulent times. And the only way is to really reconnect with ourselves, with nature, with other humans, with the universe. If not, there is going to be a big problem very soon. No?
And I guess also to accept that there are higher powers we have no control over.
Yes, but that's the beauty. We're in constant change, no?
Yeah.
We're in constant change, and we get old, we get sick, we're weak, we're strong, we're happy, we're unhappy, and that's part of life. That's the beauty of life.
Yeah, and tell me, the Wabi, so that's also, maybe you can sum it up a bit. What's like the Wabi? It's like the perfectness of imperfection, no?
The beauty of imperfection.
Beauty of imperfection, yeah.
That we just find in nature.
So it's like an aesthetic approach.
It's a very aesthetic approach, the oriental approach, and to how the accident, the non-control, the passing of time, the uniqueness of nature is beautiful by itself.
Yeah.
And just to learn how to understand and accept all that and find that in any object.
And then moving forward in your career, you started a foundation called Casa Wabi.
Yes.
And you built a building with Taro Ando, which I think is also interesting because he has a very specific idea about concrete, and it's on the south coast of Mexico.
Yes.
Yeah. And I remember when I came visit you there, I remember you told me that the locals did the concrete, and that this was not really under Ando's standard qualities, but then you were able to convince him that the beauty is in imperfection.
Well, not exactly that way. But, no. But the thing is that when we built Casa Wabi, first we tried to bring the concrete from the nearest factory.
Yeah,
it was far away, and when it arrived, it arrived melted. We decided to do it ourselves.
Yeah,
and Ando couldn't believe that we were going to do it correctly. Mm-hmm. Then we did two mock-ups, and at the end, Ando was super happy with it. But we did it by hand. Like we have the three rollers of concrete, and we were doing it every pouring by hand. Mm-hmm. And the quality of the concrete is really amazing. I mean, you can see the reflection of the sun on the seaside of Casa Wabi.
Or was it the circle, maybe?
The circle was exactly the circle. It's another story, because the circle, Ando wanted us to pour that circle. It was impossible.
Yeah.
Because a circle in diagonal, you will always have an angle that will never fill.
Exactly. This is what I remember, that he had the plan of a perfect circle.
See, a leaning circle. But yeah. It's impossible to. Yeah. No, it's not impossible. But I mean, you can do it if you are the owner of Chateau Lacoste, or I'm a poor guy. I mean, but not poor, but I mean, and at the end, we decided to make a steel frame and then just cover it with concrete. At the end, Ando was not so happy, but then he saw the result, and he understood that it was
Wabi,
no, but also it was our only way. We were finishing the construction. I was bankrupt, totally bankrupt.
Yeah.
I owe money to every single gallery I work with, to every single family member, to every single friend.
I had the same when I did build this church here.
It's part of the adventure, but I couldn't pay when we hire an engineering company how to do it, and then give us a quote that I will be, now there will be, there won't be Casa Wabi, there won't be I will be totally, maybe in jail because I didn't pay all my. So, but we he saw it and it has become a symbol of Casawabi, no?
Yeah.
That observatory or however we can call it.
So what do you do there? You have like artist studios, you work with the community?
Well, no, it's an art residency. It's several things. It's an art residency that we invite 6 artists at a time. We have been already 10 years. We have more than almost 600 artists in those 10 years. And we invite artists from different backgrounds, different age, different genders, different countries, different disciplines, no? Sometimes, mostly it's focused on painters and sculptors, but also we have had architects, filmmakers, chefs, architects.
You did many pavilions. There was like Pritzker Prize winning architects, right?
We had invited several architects to do pavilions, but pavilions that they are in use. They are not like
sculptures.
Sculptures or even vanity things, no?
Yeah.
So, for example, Kengo Kuma, I went for dinner. He wanted to meet me, and we went for a nice, very nice dinner. We were drinking a lot of sake, and then he told me that he was doing a shrine for Beatles in Kamakura. And I told him, would you like to do our chicken coop? And he said, yes, of course. So everything has been very casual. The whole process of Casawabi has been very casual.
And you have the feeling that the different places have an influence on your practice?
Yes, 100%.
Like Greece, other works reside in the practice in Greece and in Mexico.
I focus on paintings in Greece. In Casawabi, I do clay because all the craftsmen around Casawabi, they're doing bricks on clay. So I reconnect. One of the things that I got back from the project of Casawabi in a selfish way is the reconnection with clay. I'm really grateful for that from Casawabi as an entity. Of course, not as a selfish person, I have been so happy to so many artists. We have helped so much people of the community, etc. But as a selfish way, the reconnection with clay has been amazing. I mean,
When we go back to the early days, what type of paintings were you doing then? You said you were working on paper.
Yes, very influenced by maybe Tapies, maybe Miró.
And when you came back from when you dropped it and you came back after the weekend, you think this was like a key moment, or were there other moments where you thought, okay,
no,
this was
a lot of key moments, a lot. My whole career is composed by accidents, because that's my philosophy, to accept accident, to take advantage to the accident. And I always tell that to, when I have give lectures at Harvard Museum or at different places, I always tell to artists, be open to the accident, because the accident is what gives you new roads to explore.
But you can't trigger accidents.
No, you can't trigger it. They come. And you have to open to them. And the only way to trigger accidents is to work more and experiment more. If you don't experiment, it's impossible to get accidents. No, if you cook the same, every day the same pasta with the same amount of salt, pepper, it's the same result.
Yeah, like another situation is, I remember we did this installation in Basel with the mail bags.
With sack bags.
Yeah, yes, coffee bags. Which I've used to transport lettuce or?
Coffee and then chili and then lettuce and then oranges, everything, anything.
And so what was the story behind this?
Yeah, that was a beautiful installation where Sam invited us to do that show. And we put it in a public place, and they were, these sacks are so simple and so humble that we would have them outside, and the kids were going around in the fountain, and then we put these spheres of clay with seeds that people was able to
plant somewhere, right?
Pick them up and plant them in their house, and the whole concept was talking about how life continues and how prevails and the simplicity and beauty of life and earth.
And how did you come across these sacks? Because they're objet trouvés, no? They're
like, yes, totally objet trouvés.
And the circle on them is also like a ready-made.
I will explain. When the pandemic began in New York, it was a Saturday, I remember perfectly. We were in our house upstate, and I got a friend. I told my mother was visiting us in New York, and I say, listen, tomorrow morning we go back to Mexico, to Casawabi, because if the pandemic catch up us in some place, I wanted to be in Casawabi because I want the freedom of being on an open air we arrived to Casa Guavi. There were still two artists in residency, but they were trying to leave as soon as possible to their homes. And so then I began to work at Casa Guavi with clay, but the clay, my spheres and all my objects of clay, they take long time to dry, long, long time. So after 1 week, as I'm hyperactive, as I said, after 1 week, the studio was full of clay. full, totally full of clay. And I couldn't do anything else. And there were not shops to buy canvas or to buy stretchers or to buy materials. So I was fucked in a way. And one day, the only thing that was open in Puerto Escondido, the supermarkets were closed, everything was closed, but the only thing that was open, it was the market, typical Mexican market, because everybody depends on that market.
Yeah.
And so they bring one day all the shopping in these old sacks, all the oranges, the lettuce, everything was in these old sacks. There were like six sacks.
Yeah.
And I saw the sacks and they resembled me a lot of Arte Povera and they were so beautiful, so stained by time and so humble and so unique that I asked the people that was working at Casa Guavi and said, please go back to the market and buy every single sack. We had a lot of plastic bags for garbage, big plastic bags for garbage in Casa Guavi. I gave them all the plastic bags, told them, listen, tell them to transport that everything that they're transporting now in this, but sell me all the sacks. And I bought around, I don't remember, like 200 or something like that.
What's the reason for these circles on them?
Because when I got them, I realized we didn't know how long it was to last the pandemic. And I thought, okay, I have to do one every day, no more than that, because I didn't want to finish them.
Yeah.
I didn't have time. So my...
Also, again, like a therapy.
And my approach was to doing every day my interpretation of the sun or the moon of that last night, but a very abstract representation.
Okay.
And I was doing them by hand, of course.
Ah, okay, because they're perfect.
If you look at a very close look, they're not totally perfect, but they look very perfect.
Yeah. Again, Wabi perfect.
See, Wabi perfect, but also the stains of the sack, the smell, the marks that the people put on the market, they make them unique. And it also, they resemble a lot the Arte Povera. And if you remember, Arte Povera was a time after the World War, when there was a lot of uncertainty, a lot of sadness, a lot of, and that was the time, exactly the same time as the pandemic. No?
True, yeah. When it goes back to basic and pure materials.
Exactly.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, Bosco, thank you so much for taking us into the recent practice. I noticed that the show is interesting because it's so different depending on the daytime you come in.
That's something that I really love about my work is that it changed. It has so much texture. The works are such an object that they change a lot with the light.
Yeah.
And I love that the negative space that they create. And the dialogue with the space becomes very strong depending on the light.
And the works have hung pretty high. Why did you do that?
Because I wanted the church it's a church to look like a real church and to see them as windows, to see them up. They are the
like nature windows.
See the nature windows, but also they are the light at the church now. No, you have the olive tree that is the center. It means. Continuity, parentship. But then you have these windows that are a little bit up, but they bring the light to the church.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, thank you so much. So to our fathers.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And thanks for this beautiful exhibition.
Thank you so much, Joachim.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.